Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from the Word.
Check their bona fides.
Well, look, we're going to start early. Thanks very much for coming. Now, when I was at the NME in 1978, as a keen cub reporter, my dear old pal, a mentor over here, was one of the people on the staff who very kindly got me off the news desk to write joke pieces at the front. Do you remember?
For the thrill section.
Mostly about what a tosser we thought Rod Stewart was. Absolutely. Actually, I quite like him now, but we thought he was hilarious at the time. But anyway, he has written, and I'm sure you read some of them, 16 books, books about the Stones, The Clash, reggae, Bob Marley. And he is about to tell us a little bit about his 17th book. Please welcome and give a kind of real Islington-shaped, vast round of applause for the great Chris Salovich.
He does it so well.
So, Chris, the first thing we're going to get you to do, she's going to read a little section of the book, but firstly, explain the concept.
I'm sure most of you are aware of the concept of the 27 Club. It's those people who died at 27. And we've got... Amy, Kurt Cobain, Brian Jones, Jimi Hendrix, Jim Morrison, Janis Joplin, and Robert Johnson.
And we shall hear hopefully 5 or 6 bits on each one of them. It's absolutely
that's correct. Amazing. And I'm going to start off. I'm going to read a section about Kurt Cobain, which kind of defines what we're talking about, really, because the term to the 27 Club first was used, I think, during the 80s, but it was really when Kurt Cobain dies in April 1994, and his mother says, "Now he's gone and joined that stupid club. I told him not to join that stupid club." It's Wendy O'Connor, his mother. And so Wendy O'Connor, the mother of Kurt Cobain, reacted to the news of her son's self-inflicted death on the 8th of April 1994. Kurt Cobain was not the first male member of his family to kill himself. So matter of course was suicide on both sides of his family that, as a young teenager, Kurt would joke of having suicide genes. When the future Nirvana singer was 12 years old, Bert Cobain, his great uncle, brother to Kurt's grandfather Leyland, took a pistol and shot himself, first in the stomach and then in the head, finally killing himself. A year previously, ignoring medical advice that he would face death if he did not give up alcohol, Ernest Cobain, Leyland and Burl's brother, had fallen on the stairs in his house while drunk, dying from a brain aneurysm, some form of subconscious suicide, perhaps. Aneurysm, in fact, would become the title of a 1991 Nirvana song, the B-side of Smells Like Teen Spirit. However, there seems little link to Ernest Cobain's tragic fate. Charles R. Cross, Cobain's biographer, asserts that Kurt wrote the lyrics to Aneurysm about his ex-girlfriend, musician Toby Vail. On his mother, Wendy's side, Kurt's great-grandfather had stabbed himself in front of the entire family. It's a little bit of a downer, this. I'm sorry about this.
It gets worse.
Admitted to a mental hospital, he finally killed himself 2 months later by tearing apart his healing wounds. It must have seemed almost an everyday occurrence when, as an early teenager, Kurt and a pair of friends found the hanging body of a boy who had done away with himself. So, you're inclined to muse, was Kurt's end inevitable? Surviving members of families in which suicide has occurred are frequently haunted by the fear that it runs in the family, that one day they too might take their own lives. Mental health problems run in many families, and it's worth recalling that the third single off Nevermind was Lithium, a song that took the name of the drug that allegedly treated manic depressive, bipolar as it's become termed, behaviour. This was an affliction from which Kurt certainly suffered, though it's not known whether he ever took lithium. Yet, tragedy in the family can act as a spur for other members. Was this the case with this highly sensitive and intelligent, innately artistic boy who had utterly changed the course of 1990s music? In 1991, Nirvana revealed themselves as the last great American rock band, one which emerged seemingly from nowhere to sell over 30 million copies of Nevermind. Nirvana are as indelibly the sound of America's West Coast as the Beach Boys. But this is a different West Coast, marinated in rain, mist and darkness. In the vanguard of what became known as the grunge movement, the sludgy fusion of punk rock and heavy metal that emerged from the Pacific Northwest, Nirvana's seemingly sudden success overturned the American music business. Until then, alternative music had seemed marginal at best in its sales potential. But now it was evident there was a critical mass of fans apparently waiting for just such an act to materialize. Nirvana shook the world with their music. Their explosive arrival opened the floodgates for acts previously marginalized as part of America's resolutely independent music scene. Several such bands became part of the most exciting movement since punk 15 years previously, of which Nirvana were direct descendants. REM, already frontrunners, Pearl Jam, Smashing Pumpkins, Dinosaur Jr., Rage Against the Machine, Screaming Trees, Jane's Addiction, and, for Kurt, the spiritual godfathers, Sonic Youth, now swept all before them. Not only was Kurt Cobain the most successful musician of his generation, he was the rock and roll god of his age, a rock star, a father, an anti-style icon, a junkie, a suicide. Yet, his was also the story of what happens to a man when he gets what he wants. Kurt took the universal pain of a child of divorce and expressed it. The parents of Nirvana bassist Chris Novoselic and drummer Dave Grohl had also split up. His persistent feelings of utter isolation were so archetypal that he managed to truly connect with an enormous audience. Kurt seemed an almost professional loser, which was why he became such a huge star. Everyone identified with him and his struggle to be himself. Yet, there was always an element of pose. And although Kurt Cobain seemed the personification of what would soon become known as Generation X slacker apathy, he was also a very good actor. He was largely content to go along with anything that could boost his success, perfectly prepared to sign with a headline label, to ditch an inappropriate drummer, and to accept huge paychecks for playing major festivals. Yet, he was persistently conflicted over his role as a star, uncomfortable with the financial rewards it brought. Nirvana were a punk act that drew on the spirit of the Sex Pistols' Nevermind the Bollocks, on the churning drive of Led Zeppelin and Black Sabbath, and on the melodic possibilities of the Beatles, with whose music Kurt had grown up. Many of his relatives loved the English group. "My aunts would give me Beatles records," he told John Savage. "For the most part, it was just Beatles records." In fact, many of Kurt's influences were from the UK. Appropriately, at the end of 1991, when Nevermind was surging up the US charts, Nirvana were touring Britain and then Europe, largely unaware that their lives were about to be utterly transformed. An anti-hero figurehead for his generation in his moth-holed thrift store woolen apparel. In January 1992, Kurt Cobain and Nirvana dislodged Michael Jackson's Dangerous album from its long stint at the top of the US album charts. As a cultural figure, Kurt represented a very specific moment when a unique sense of community, the global Nirvana community, emerged from popular culture. The early 1990s were a period of recession and war, both in the Gulf and the former Yugoslavia. And Kurt's hand-me-down garb was the antithesis of the designer besotted late 1980s. His rebel music bespoke the soul of a difficult, dysfunctional individual, which was precisely the interior landscape of many of his fans. As the Beatles had done with Liverpool, Bob Marley with Kingston, Jamaica, and Bruce Springsteen with New Jersey's Asbury Park, Nirvana put Seattle on the musical map. Seattle, which has a population of 3 million, has a long-standing liberal progressive outlook and is an affluent city. But it does not enjoy an easy climate. Central to the sound of Nirvana is the mildly depressive, laconic feel of the American Pacific Northwest, where rain clouds ceaselessly tumble inland from over the vast ocean and sit over the blustery city. It was only later that it became known that Nirvana were not actually from Seattle at all. The biggest city in Washington State happened to be the one to which Kurt Cobain and bass player Chris Novoselic had eventually relocated. From the logging town of Aberdeen, 3 hours' drive to the southwest. This is where they'd grown up, a town with an 18,000 population that has an average rainfall of almost 100 inches. Grays Harbor County, in which the town is located, has one of the highest suicide rates in the United States. Later, Alice Wheeler, Kurt's photographer friend, would visit Kurt in Aberdeen. It would always be raining, she said. You'd always witness some kind of domestic violence.
So this is an absolutely incredible cocktail of really miserable, cold, wet, and oppressive weather.
Grim stuff.
A terrible divorce, a lot of ghastly things that he experiences, and also a lot of illness. I mean, he had a very bad spinal problem for which he had to take
that's
drugs.
That's correct, which is made worse, of course, by playing the guitar. He has nervous colitis. He's on tablets all the time, which the heroin alleviates.
So we have here all the basic ingredients for an absolute catastrophe. Really.
Absolutely.
But the other interesting thing in the book is that you're talking about how this, the idea that he has to express himself and paints.
Oh, his paintings
are
fantastic.
Over the walls,
and the main thing he wants to do when he's a kid, you know, five, six, what he gets for Christmas presents, birthday presents, he gets pencils, he gets paints. He gets stuff that would help him with that. And actually, in the film Montage of Heck, which came out earlier in the year, I don't know if any of you saw it, that's the first place, really, where his paintings have been exposed. And they're kind of fantastic. But he thought, I knew I was a good artist, but I knew I was kind of the best... I knew I was the best artist in Aberdeen, probably. But outside of Aberdeen, I knew it wouldn't amount to anything.
What was his relationship like with the rest of the band? Did they regard him as quite volatile and likely to commit suicide?
Well, as time goes on, they're pretty concerned. But I at first, you know, from what I understand, Kurt is doing heroin. You know, before they're successful, it's not just they're doing lots of drugs basically, and all of them.
Right. Because it always interests me the story about. Was it when Ian Curtis was found dead that the rest of the band said, "Oh, we never thought he meant it."
Oh, that's right.
You know what I mean? All the kind of depressive lyrics.
Well,
they
I think they know. But I mean, for example, before Kurt shoots himself, a few weeks before, in the same month, he'd taken an overdose of 60 Rohypnol in Rome. So it's obvious something's going on here. Right. But I think, you know, it's almost... But he's into kind of existentialist acts as well. So it is tricky because he would, you know, in Aberdeen, he would... I mean, he loathed the American gun culture of hunting. And so he'd see trucks with, you know, rifles, racks in them, and he'd go and he'd paint queer on them.
Right.
That's
great
detail.
Wasn't there a detail in the book where his stepfather... his mother threw a load of his stepfather's guns in the lake.
Yeah, yeah. This is what happens, of course, is, I mean, that pivotal moment where it all seems to go wrong is when he's eight, when his parents split up. And his mother starts living with a guy who's paranoid schizophrenic. So he goes to live with his father, which is in Aberdeen. And then he goes, and that's the part of the problem. You know, where is he living? You know, where are his roots? He keeps going back and forth. He goes back to his mother's place. His mother has got the new boyfriend, thrown all his weapons into the river. Kurt goes and the next morning and digs them out and goes and buys his first amp.
Sells them and buys the amplifier. It's
exactly.
Just extraordinary sequence of events.
Yeah.
Just one last question before we get onto the next person, because they're all connected actually. But you described Courtney Love brilliantly as a former stripper and Oregon Reform School alumnus, which I like very much. Well, what's the attraction with Courtney?
Well, you see, there's a side of Courtney which people don't seem to appreciate. I met Courtney on the set of the Alex Cox film Straight to Hell in El Maria, the Spanish spaghetti western sets, in 87. I spent a couple of days with her, actually, with her and Joe Strummer and Dick Rude, probably not his real name, in a Dodge car, smoking spliffs, obviously. And Courtney's really nice. She's a really sweet girl.
She used to hang around with Echo and the Bunnymen.
She used to hang out with Julian Cope, actually. She's really sweet. So you see that, you know, the monster that she's described as so frequently, there's another side to her completely. So you can see what's... And Courtney, in fact, does try towards the end. You know, she does try to have, as they call it in AA, she just try to have an intervention. She gets everyone, into the house in Seattle and tries to persuade him to go to a clinic, and actually kind of succeeds, but of course he's there for a couple of days. It's quickly on a plane out of there. But so she does try her best.
Well, as we shall see with all of these individuals, that it's relationships, it's the family. We've got pictures of early pictures of them, late pictures, because the early life of all seven of these people fascinating.
But there's an important point to make about all these people. They're all really bright.
Yeah.
They're all incredibly intelligent. I mean, we just go back to Kurt for a second, because he, of course, is diagnosed as ADD. Attention deficit disorder, given tablets. But you can tell, no, he's just bright. He just wants to get on with stuff, But they always seem very keen on that. And it's the same with, in America, that's the same with Amy. And also, Kurt's parents split up when he's 8. Her parents split up when she's 9. And it all seems to go a bit weird from there, basically.
But the key thing, as far as I can see, about Amy Winehouse is, of many, but the main thing is her relationship with her father. Would that be right? Because her father left the house when she was home.
The father leaves, and there's this almost desperate desire to always get Dad back. I think it's no coincidence at all that when she dies, her father is on tour. He's in America about to start a tour, which, of course, she's financed, and she's financed the making of his record. It's all a bit iffy and a bit dodgy.
Well, as it was obvious in that documentary.
You see in the film.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Right. I mean, when she goes to St. Lucia to try and clean up, effectively, he goes over there with a film crew.
Oh, it's a point. I'm sure a lot of you have seen the film, but there's a terrible moment in the film where she decides to go to rehab, and he steps in and says, "Are you sure? Do you remember that?" And she says, "Well, I'm not so sure." She said, "Well, it's your decision. You don't be pushed into it." And she doesn't go to rehab.
He's making remarks to the press about, "Oh, well, no, we all dabble with drugs. We all did that when I was a kid. She's not really got a problem." But to me, Amy somehow sums up this problem. Maybe it's because it's the most recent, but Amy is a kind of... Amy's personifies the Ladette of 10, 15 years ago. She's one of those girls who you'd see, on a Friday night, squatting down behind the phone box having a pee, basically, at quarter to 12 at night. She's like completely... She's completely going for it.
Would you also say, because I've got a feeling that, that there are certain people, Sandy Denny is a really good example, actually, and Janis Joplin, that they were trying to, it's hard enough being a woman in a man's world, but I got the impression with her that she just tried to be a man.
Yeah, well, that's what I mean. That's kind of what Ladette culture is,
she
exactly.
She was just literally
drinking
pints.
She wants to be a bloke, exactly.
Yeah.
But you can see, in her, what happens to her in her body. I mean, there's that classic time in, 2007, 2008, one forgets about what was happening, in the tabloid press with regards to Amy, which is, she was at the end of 2007, she's on the front cover of the Evening Standard with some coke residue in her nose. And the next few weeks later, she's in the Sun, there's video footage of her with a crack pipe. I mean, it's really out of control. She goes, she checks into the Sanderson, I think the October of 2007, the Sanderson Hotel in Berners Street with Blake Field, a civil, to whom she was by then married. And then she's found in the street outside running away, hitches a ride with some girls, and then goes back 2 hours later. And what's happened is, and she's covered in blood, of course, and what's happened is that she says she had hired a prostitute to go to their room with them to do drugs together. But the thing also about her also is like...
We've all done that.
But the thing about her is everyone says, oh, well, you know, she's 24, she's a grown-up. No, there's no 24-year-olds here, are there? No. They're kids. These are kids. And the other and I feel no one is really looking after them. No one's really keeping an eye on this
situation.
I really
agree with that, because she seemed to me to be an absolutely incredibly gifted technician, as all
obviously,
seven of these people are.
Obviously.
Incredible singer, and can really do very little else apart from sing, which is what she really wanted to do. Everything else she couldn't really deal with, and also everything else she wasn't protected against
by a large number of people there to protect her. There's no reason why she should be able to deal with those situations, because no one has shown her. I mean, when she dies, there's a bloke, a bodyguard, in quotes, in her home, outside the bedroom. Well, looked in at 10 o'clock, seemed to be asleep. Looks in at 4 o'clock, she's dead. Well, actually, you're maybe not really doing your job, old chap.
Yeah. Well, one of the most heartbreaking bits...
And everyone around her seems to be like that.
One of the most heartbreaking bits of the film is where she was taken out of the house in Camden, unconscious, lifted off a sofa... put in the back of a car, driven to a private aircraft and a landing strip, flown to Spain to honour a $1 million concert, which she was incapable of playing, stood up, pushed on stage, take off stage, put the car, flown home again.
And there's also the Serbia... There's the gig in Serbia, not long before she goes, where she she's really drunk on Slivovich. But the idea was, apparently, was... Why is she so bad when she gets on stage? You know, she's clearly completely drunk. Oh, because the coke was no good. The coke was supposed to have straightened her out.
Yeah, again, it's a fair point, isn't it? But look, we're going to move on to... Because my theory, reading your fantastic book, is all of these people, that there are there's usually one significant event that happens. And my feeling about Brian Jones... The next person we're going to talk about, there is Brian, just before he died on the right, age 27, was that Brian Jones...
Not looking very good there, though.
Yeah, not looking... Yes.
Not looking too bad there, actually.
Not looking too... Actually, no, maybe not.
I don't know.
Brian, interesting, he had three children by the age of 19, am I right?
He did have three children by the time he was 19. But I think the pivotal moment, what goes wrong for Brian, is that when he's four, his parents, who are kind of very sort of ordinary middle-class Cheltenham people, he's from Cheltenham... there's a two-year-old sister who dies. And the parents very quick... And he developed his... One of the problems when he's in that swimming pool at the end is the asthma. And he has asthma for the rest of his life. That's when he first develops the asthma. And his parents very quickly have another daughter. And it's said that the mother, withdrew all her love from him and put it all onto the new sister. You know, kind of fairly sort of... You can imagine it, can't you? You know?
Completely. But throughout the chapter... It's this extraordinary triangular relationship between Brian Jones, who's the leader of the group, and the real looker at the front,
exactly.
Architect of their sound, and Mick Jagger and Keith Richards.
Yes.
That changes all the time.
Of course.
And there's an amazing moment when he was discovered by the others in 63 or 64 to have organised a deal whereby he got £5
Another
more
£5 a week.
Is that right?
Because he's the leader of the group. Because he's the one who deals with the contract. When Andrew Lou Goldham and Eric Easton have been to see them in Richmond.
But the other Stones, immediately...
That was supposed to be the moment. Yes, they will hate him for that.
They hated him.
Absolutely hate him.
He's getting £5 more a week than we are.
But I think it's as much... I think it's as much that... You know, you think of the Rolling Stones now, everyone thinks of Keith Richards, more than Mick Jaggery. In the 60s, no one thought of Keith Richards for one second. Then you didn't hardly even thought of Mick Jagger. The person who looks fantastic and is the visual image of the Rolling Stones is Brian Jones.
He's at the front of the great Gerard Mankiewicz picture, isn't he?
Yeah, of course. But in fact, by the time they do... What's the album after Out of Our Heads, the one that shot up on
Between the Buttons?
Between the Buttons. He's at the back.
Right. Yeah. Yes, because he looks pretty bad there.
He looks pretty at the back, you know. Yeah. Something has shifted at that point.
Yeah.
But they basically, I think they just bully him out of the group.
Completely. There's a terrible bit at the end where didn't they just leave him by the side of the road and drive?
Oh yeah, that's quite early on. They're going to a gig in Portsmouth, I think, and he goes. Brian liked to be early. Yeah, like Keith, he liked to get there, be professional about it. And his car breaks down, his Rover breaks down. And they see him standing by the side of the road and just drive past him.
Well, there's an even worse moment when they go to Morocco, which I'm sure you all know. When Keith, the whole band are there, but Keith and Anita Pallenberg.
Who's his...
His girlfriend.
Brian's girlfriend, but by the end of the journey, Keith's girlfriend... And they left him
in the hotel in Morocco to pay the whole bill exactly. And stole his girlfriend.
Brian has gone off to the Atlas Mountains, you know,
back.
There's a significant point about Brian. Brian's the guy who invents world music. He invents world music with the
But while he's off buying an owl, they've stolen his girlfriend and left him the bill.
And there's a bit I've quoted from Keith's, I think, some meretricious autobiography. Is, I never saw a guy so affected by fame. The minute we'd had a couple of successful records, zoom, he was Venus and Jupiter rolled into one. Huge inferiority complex you hadn't noticed. He became a pain in the neck, a kind of rotting attachment. This is like 41, written, comes out 41 years after he's died. You think, leave it out, Keith, please.
No, absolutely.
Apocryphal point. I just want this confirming. Brian Jones has three children by the time he's 19.
That's correct.
Were they all called Julian?
Sorry?
Were they all called Julian? Somebody told me that.
I think they might. Two of them certainly were. Yeah.
Just like
the name.
It can, to save it the bottle can, of.
Yeah, yeah. Just saves that confusion.
Richard, Julian, whatever your name is.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yes.
As an experienced parent.
Two of them are. Yeah. Exactly.
But it's an interesting point that Keith and Mick, who I suppose would have been two years younger than him, were incredibly impressed by the idea that a 19-year-old had three children.
And then of course. So therefore, almost to prove a point, Mick goes and shags his then girlfriend.
That's nice, isn't it?
That won't go down well.
No, that will not go down well. No.
I do think they kind of bullied him out of the group. I don't think he was murdered for one second.
No, really. So Jimi Hendrix, that's the picture of Hendrix.
Well, Jimi's life is kind of worse than Dickensian. You know, His mother is 17.
Oh, it's a bit of a horror show, this, isn't it? Sorry.
Are there any social workers in the house?
Jimmy's mother, Lucille, is 17 and is working in bars, which in America, obviously, you're not allowed to do.
Underage and pregnant.
The father. It's the war. It's 1943. He's drafted. He goes off into the Navy. But she has plenty of other boyfriends during that time. But the point about the drinking is that there's several more. There's two sisters and two brothers. They're born. The first one is he's okay, but Jimmy is looking after him from the age of five, cooking meals for him. But one of them has this just horrendous birth deformities. Basically, there's cleft palates, there's club foot. One of the girls is born blind. They're adopted. So it's a completely ghastly situation. He's taken off, Jimmy is taken, there's another guy who she's involved, before the dad comes back, he's taken by this guy who I think was actually pimping Lucille to Portland, Oregon, but because that's crossing the straight line, she's underage. He's imprisoned. When he gets out of jail, and by which point Al is back, you know, he comes to try and reclaim her. And Al actually has a fight in the street with him and ends that situation.
Again, if your mother is an underage girl singing in a bar, didn't he call it? That was where he got the phrase "electric lady."
She's the electric lady.
Electric lady,
and so there's no surprise also that when two girlfriends in New York in '66 are both prostitutes, one white, one black, and then in about 18 months later, I think it's the beginning of no, it's the end of it's '67. Devon Wilson, who he's with, who's quite a well-known groupie in quotes. He's with her in L.A. and then in New York. She's also a prostitute. But because Lucille is... That's his female archetype. That's what he's looking for in a woman. But even when Lucille dies, when she's, that's his idea of stability, exactly. When Lucille dies, when she's 33, Jimmy isn't allowed to, you know, Jimmy and his brother aren't allowed to go to the funeral, and they're furious with Al about that. What's that about? Because Al hasn't even got the money to get the gas to drive across Seattle to the cemetery.
So presumably in all these
it's
cases...
It's a disaster.
All these people come from difficult families, and their success then introduces into this family this terrible destabilizing effect of them of money and fame.
Yeah,
which presumably makes the families far worse and, you know, accentuates whatever unfortunate tendencies they've got. Is that what happened in every case here? Presumably the family end up arguing about the money.
Well, after they die.
Or even before.
I mean, even before, yes. The Amy situation, we have to be careful of the libel.
No,
here,
sure,
I think.
Allegedly, and we're talking about
Who's that man at the back? That's essentially what... But I don't think, you know, there are certain... Well, I mean, Jim Morrison, it doesn't happen because he said his parents are dead and won't have anything to do with them, so...
I went to the unveiling of a Jimi Hendrix plaque in May on the House of Mayfair, and one of his uncles stepped out of the crowd. So those guys are around, and they're looking for some kind of pot of gold. Just
uncles.
Really briefly, that picture up on the screen there on the left is Jimmy's brief kind of army bit. Just tell us about that, because a lot of people don't know that he was very briefly in the army.
He was in the army, and... you know, the story they used to give out, well, at first was given out, was that he broke his ankle in a parachute jump and was invalided out. No, he really wanted to get out. He said, no, I'm gay. That's how he got out.
So he never jumped out of a plane at all?
He probably did. You know, he probably did. Yeah.
It takes a bit of training.
Because he's in the paratroopers. So, yeah. You know,
right. So he served.
So he didn't break his ankle.
No, okay, fine.
Well, our next candidate for our next
happy family.
Yes, right. Next on the couch is Janis Joplin. It's an amazing picture of Janis Joplin on the left there with her school's mortal.
Innocent little girl.
I know, it's fantastic. So just tell us a bit about
her. At that point, all the guys in the school choir knew that if you wanted to feel someone up afterwards, you'd give her Janis.
That's lovely, isn't it?
She's about 13 or 14.
There's a brief moment in this which I refuse to believe in Chris's book, but he tells me it's true, is that on a trip, was it the Warner Brothers train, the journey where there was the Grateful Dead?
Who
were the bands on this?
There's the Grateful Dead, the band, Delaney and Bonnie, a couple of others.
But anyway, there was a 5-day tour on a train, and Chris alleges that Janis Joplin had sex 65 times. Now, to be fair, she was a bisexual,
energetic.
But that's a lot.
And it was probably
a lot of sex.
It's probably quite quick.
And there's no buffet service on the
buffet.
Exactly.
No, you couldn't get a signal.
Find your entertainment.
You made your own entertainment.
It was a slow train.
Get hashtag different times. Exactly. Yeah. But look, go back. Her family actually quite supportive, weren't they?
They're kind of intellectuals. This is Port Arthur, Texas, which is the other point. This point is the oil capital of the world. It's inland, actually. It's about 20 miles inland, but you know, connected to the sea, but through canals. It's also, because this is the 50s and 60s, well, the 40s when we start off, it's the South, and it's viciously racially segregated. The family can see themselves as intellectuals, but so she's given a piano from the age of 3 to learn how to play, but because she's not playing Chopin, which father who actually does also smoke marijuana and make bathtub gin.
The father who paid for the piano
wants Chopin. No, it's taken away from her. So there's a lot of conflict there. But there's also clearly Janice's conflict is kind of, you know, she wants to be an artist, and she's got that background. She's got that nurturing, and she's sort of being permitted to go in that way. But at the same time, so she's at university, but she leaves university to become a secretary. And the parents are concerned about her. They send her to, they've got relatives in Brentwood in Los Angeles, which is a kind of, you know, sort of fairly, you know, relatively conservative area. So she goes there in the summer holidays, I think it's when she's 15, school holidays, long vacation in America, of course, and ends up instead in Venice, which is, you know, the heart of beat culture.
Yeah.
And then this, here's what's going on in San Francisco. Hitchhikes up to San Francisco, meets Ferlinghetti, goes to City Lights Books, meets Ferlinghetti the poet, but also starts her, you know, but gets a speed habit early there. So, you know, so efforts by her parents' situation, they haven't quite worked.
No, but and going back to the parents again, and we're going to go into this in more detail in the Jim Morrison chapter to come. She, when she became successful, she started to really, really be disgracefully untruthful about what happened with her. She said that they kicked her out of her home. Yeah. But they forced her to leave home when she's 14. This is absolutely untrue.
Yet at the
so
same,
why did she do that?
Well, because she wants to be seen as a rebel, because she doesn't want it to be known that actually she's sending letters to her mum saying, "Mum, I met, you know, Paul McCartney. He's a Beatle." So she's very excited
but
about
how did
that.
Her parents react? So getting, you're absolutely right, there's a bit in the book where she sends all these postcards reporting on each concert. And she says very tellingly how great it feels to be on stage. And I really feel I've become someone.
Exactly.
And at the same time, they're reading the papers saying my parents threw me out of the home when I was 14. They're back and big bastards.
They're a bit upset.
Yeah, they
just can't resist saying things like that in interviews, can they? Because they just get people on their side, you know. So if you've suddenly become famous in this kind of world, people are putting microphones in front of you every day, and encouraging you to fantasize about yourself.
Come up with some stuff, basically.
To make yourself legendary. And what nobody ever does is say, well, we just got by, and we're fine, and mum and dad are fine, and I got 4 O-levels.
They were very supportive.
Everybody's always thrown out of school.
I was born in a base bin. I was raised by wolves.
If the number of rock stars, you know, who claim to be thrown out of school were actually thrown out of school, there'd be questions in Parliament, you know.
Pete Doherty and his dad.
Is it?
Probably gets on with him very well.
Well, whatever. I'm sure that's the case.
This is Father's Day, I'm sure.
Shall we move on?
I was going to ask you one last question. There's so much detail in the book. There's a bit where she's interviewed, just before her death, actually, around the time of this photograph, when she's interviewed by Newsweek, and there's an incredible observation. She says she's eating breakfast. She says that her breakfast is an unlovely concoction made from wood alcohol and chocolate syrup. And you're just thinking, what kind of a state must this girl be?
Junky food.
Absolutely.
Junky
food. I mean, it's appalling.
Those people we knew on the NME would have that.
Yes, they were, Nick Kent here.
Whose names will be available later.
We'll edit that out.
I wasn't thinking.
On that bombshell, Nick Kent took drugs, you know. This is an astonishing... Well, they're all astonishing chapters. This is astonishing. So just give us some idea of the... That's Jim Morrison and his, I suppose, his high school picture, isn't it, I think? So give us some idea of the background. Very middle class.
His father's...
highly educated.
More than middle class. His father's an admiral who in charge of an aircraft carrier.
There are many admirals,
in the Gulf of Vietnam. So there's a tricky...
Let me just make this point clear, because it's absolutely... This is a real revelation to me. Ticking away inside him, this little engine, when Jim Morrison's at the absolute top of his curve with the Doors, is the fact that he, the fabulous anti-establishment, anti-Vietnam War emblem, father is operating the aircraft carrier.
Killing the gooks.
Bombing Vietnam. Right.
Exactly. While he's singing 5-1.
While he's singing 5-1. It's absolutely astonishing.
Probably why he felt he couldn't see his parents after about February 1968, which he didn't.
Well, in fact, he didn't.
But he also puts out, he puts out the story that they're dead.
I thought that they were dead, or they'd abused him, or something.
He was apparently abused by a relative.
Yeah.
But he puts out that they're dead. But the significant point of for Jim Morrison, which is actually displayed quite well in Oliver Stone's film The Doors, which a lot of people don't like, but I think it's quite good, is when he's 4, because they move, military family, they move around a lot. So there's a lack of stability there. But they move around a lot. They're in New Mexico. And they're driving along somewhere in the country, and they come across a vehicle containing with Native American Indians. It's crashed. It's upside down. There's people killed. There's people moaning and screaming. That's a sort of pivotal moment for him, which returns in his lyrics. Yeah.
Very like Kurt Cobain.
Exactly.
I know. And just one last question before we get on to the last of this rogues gallery. I get the impression that he was a genuinely unpleasant person. I'm sorry. Jim Morrison seemed horrible to me. An absolutely horrible individual.
I'm not sure. I didn't have that feeling. Well, look, I do want to say one thing. I want to say about... Well, he may have been foul, but I want to say... I don't think he was horrible to everyone, but I hadn't really listened to The Doors for kind of years before I started doing this again. Absolutely fantastic. I'd forgotten
they're
how incredible,
records.
Incredible they
brilliant
are.
Records.
Absolutely brilliant. And they're also completely unique in their time. You understood why they were so huge in America. Because there's, in the world really, because there's no one like them. Those sort of jazzy undertones, the keyboards, and his lyrics, I think, are sensational. I remember being on the NME and people saying, oh, his lyrics, not very good.
Not as good as Sham 69. No,
lyrics are sensationally good. You know, he's a great poet of our times.
So why do they all go at 27?
Sorry?
What's the significance of 27?
27, the ages of 28 to 32 are supposed to be a transition to adulthood. That's when you're supposed to be, I'm still trying to get that. But that's supposed to be, so these people have all, this is the simplistic version. They're supposed to be the transition to adulthood.
And they're facing maturity.
And these people are already burnt out by that time. So they don't make. They basically don't make that transition. Right. It's kind of as simple as that, really.
Right.
And I kind of accept that, you know.
Well, we put that picture up there on the left. That's the old Delta Blues Singers, King of Delta Blues Singers album cover, which I'm old enough to remember as a kid, because when that came out, there were no pictures
of
Robert
pictures,
Johnson.
That's correct.
And there are only three now, I think, was the famous one.
Yeah.
And I remember when we saw that, when Eric Clapton and Peter Green, all those people heard that, nobody knew what he looked like, which is astonishing now, isn't it?
That's correct.
And that's what he looked like.
Yeah, you had to go to Dobell's on Charing Cross Road to get the record.
Everybody's really fed up when a picture turned up where he was grinning cheerfully.
Yeah, because they all thought he'd be wearing a kind of terrible old denim work suit. He's got a handkerchief in his top pocket.
He looks fantastic.
I know, he looks superb.
And he was, and he always looked fantastic.
He's going down to the WAG club.
Yeah. Those are the things about Robert Johnson. He was really stylish.
Yes, yeah.
And also, but he's also another one. He's like, you know, when he's 16, he has a wife who's 14 and who dies in childbirth. And the child died too. And it's all up. But generally speaking, maybe that's why, in fact, generally speaking, all his girlfriends are much older after that.
Yeah.
But obviously mother figures too. You know?
We'll just get on to his family in a moment, but there's a brilliant line in the book where you're talking about, we all grew up with this myth of Robert Johnson, you know, the selling his soul to the devil at the crossroads. And you put it very well, it's the myth of the Mississippi set Jacobean tragedy rewritten by Tennessee Williams. Is not true.
No, it's complete bollocks.
So explain why
this is complete racist crap, basically. It's because it's this whole idea, it's a complete misinterpretation of African animist religions which have several gods, you know, many gods, and there's the notion of the crossroads god, you know, which is about, the decision you're taking in your life at that point. That's all it is. You know, and there's the idea of, you know, the idea he had the evil eye. No, he had a cataract, actually. You know, and also there's that point about the crossroads equally that...
Don't spoil it.
He's trying to hitchhike. He's just trying to hitchhike.
It's a roundabout.
He's expressing the terror. It's a roundabout, exactly.
He's
expressing the terror of trying to hitchhike out of there in the White South because he could be lynched.
Yep.
This whole thing about he sold his soul to the devil is just such simplistic nonsense. And also, he goes off into the wilderness for a couple of years. He finds a mentor. He finds someone who's going to instruct, because he couldn't play very, he was considered not to be able to play guitar that well. He finds someone who really spends 2 years teaching him how to become a master craftsman at what he's doing. And then he goes back and people are amazed. So that's how that story was complete.
No, absolutely. But also, there's a lot of evidence that the set that he played was just the popular music.
Oh, it's great. Yes,
time.
No, he's playing polkas. He's playing Bing Crosby songs.
Bing Crosby songs, you know, polkas, dance music.
Country and Western songs. You know, he's not... I mean, he has this big hit with Terraplane. Well, big hit, Terraplane Blues sold 5,000 copies. It's a local hit. But that's what also probably led to his... end, because it makes him much more popular with women. But he was, you know, he was kind of successful, basically.
Remind people of his
amazing.
End if they don't know it. It's a terrible
Sorry?
Story.
Sorry?
Remind people of how he met his end if they don't know it.
No, absolutely. It's Robert Johnson is having another of his endless affairs with, you know, but in fact, she's a younger woman, but this time. And he's going to play a... He's going to do a gig. It's Saturday night. He's going to do a gig in one of these juke joints. but actually it's the juke joint of the husband of the woman he's having the affair with. And it's bootleg whiskey because it's a dry state. It's Mississippi. And it's mothballed, dissolved in the bootleg whiskey that do for him, which was apparently a standard kind of way of, you know, there's people have problems, you put mothballs in their drink. Usually they don't die. After about 4 days, they recover. But his, you know, his body is so damaged by, you know, his years on the road. He didn't just play in the South, by the way. Robert Johnson rides trains to New York. He rides to Canada. He goes all over the place. And makes, you know, reasonable money. You know, reasonable money. It's not a lot at all, but he makes a reasonable living. But anyway, after 3 days, he dies, basically, from mothballs. So watch out. When next time you smell someone's coat, this time of year, actually, watch out.
I have to say, we haven't got time to get onto this, actually, but the book is not just about the catastrophes that befall these people. Fascinating it is. There's a lot of it really well written about the music that they made. And
yeah,
a lot of what
I
made
I thought that was quite important.
Well, no, she's really
quite important.
And really,
get that aspect
I don't want you to get the
in,
impression
actually.
That Chris has written a kind of tabloid attack on these people, because it's simply superb. And that's really all the time we've got to talk about it. But I have to say, it's a brilliant, brilliant book. I've really learned a lot about all seven of them. It's fantastic, very fast moving, immense amounts of information.
And Chris has brought along a bunch of copies.
Yes, I've got
in
some
a
out there. Yes.
And he's going straight on to another function, and he doesn't wish to take them with him to the backpack.
That's right. So please help. Lighten
his load. Chris will be delighted to sell it to you. Chris Salovech.
Thanks very much.
Thanks, guys. Thanks.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.